Hello, hi, and welcome back to The Conservation Realist. It's late April 2024, and it's been a busy several months, but I'm glad to be resuming this project. I'm Dr. Tara Sayuri-Witty, and I am a conservation consultant working primarily in the coastal realm. And this is a side project of mine, kind of a little passion project, to share insights that I've learned over my years of working in the field, to share insights from the occasional interview that I arrange, and with this season, season two, to increasingly focus on sort of training podcasts and working towards training series for students and any professionals who are interested in building skills in areas where I have a certain amount of expertise and experience. And the reason I do this as a side project is, as many of you know who have been listening, I now divide my time between conservation work, but increasingly I work with non-speaking autistic folks as a communication method practitioner. This stems from my work with my brother, Danny Witty, who's a non-speaking autistic advocate and writer, and with whom I have worked in communication for the past 4 years. So, here we are. I'm currently in Saigon as part of my long-awaited return to Southeast Asia. I've been based in San Diego since the pandemic and haven't done any field work since 2019. So I'm here for some field work, for some meetings, workshops, etc. And Saigon, what a fantastic city. It is one of my favorite places to visit. I've never been somewhere with such a density of vegetarian food options, which is one of the big perks for me here. But really the main perk is that I get to visit dear friend colleagues while I'm here, to catch up on life and nerd out on conservation and maybe scheme up some great ideas together, which often happens when we gather. So this is week 6 of my 7-week trip to the region. So this is definitely my longest time away from my brother in 4 years. I used to come to Southeast Asia frequently, and I've lived out here full time in the past. It was such a part of my life that for years I would actually plan my regular haircuts and medical checkups to be in Bangkok. So when I ended up being based in San Diego again, I wasn't even really sure where to go for those things. Southeast Asia, it's such a wonderful, vibrant part of the world. And it's also a part of the world with so much natural beauty and biodiversity, while at the same time, unfortunately, suffering largely from extensive, let's say, poor governance and high levels of exploitation. But there are many dedicated, admirable people and organizations doing work out here on conservation, resource management, and communities, and I'm really grateful to have many of them as friends and colleagues. So, as I mentioned, it's my first time back in 4 years, my first time back since I almost became stranded here as COVID-19 lockdowns began about 4 years ago. And that's wild to me. 4 years. That's like a typical high school or university span of time. And of course, these 4 years were really defined by the pandemic, so pretty tumultuous, and all that came with it, right? But really, for the most part, now that I'm here, it feels as if my extended time away from Southeast Asia almost never happened, at least on the surface. Of course, there's been turnover in businesses, but not as much as I'd assumed. The most noticeable changes on the surface that I've seen in my relatively brief time here include massive, let's say, invasive tourism. And I've heard that it's partly due to what some people call revenge tourism, which I think is an odd way to describe it, but I won't get into that here. And also fueled by ever more gluttonous and frenzied objectification of places and experiences on social media. And maybe you can tell I have many thoughts on this, but that's not what I want to focus on now. So there's still over-exploitation in the region, of course. That's been the case for decades, exacerbated now by weakened capacity or weakened investment in monitoring and enforcement during the pandemic and during other social and political shifts that have happened in the meantime, such as a coup in Myanmar, as the interviews with Yin Yin Tae and Tanda Koji last season went into. And because of that, I haven't been able to visit Myanmar, which is one of the places that is particularly meaningful to me. So I just, you know, am enjoying at least being in a similar time zone. Another thing is, of course, the impacts of climate change continue to manifest. I mean, fishermen were already describing these impacts when I started working here in the marine realm like 15 years ago. And so we have extreme weather and decreased predictability of seasonal transitions, which are critically important to fishers and farmers. And this year's El Nino has been really tough on the region, which has been experiencing more than usual droughts and particularly intense heat. So April in much of the region is not the most pleasant physical experience anyway, but it is actually particularly brutal this year. So this trip has really meant a lot to me so far. It's really inspired a lot of deep thoughts. Well, I think they're deep. But what I really want to focus on here is my profound appreciation for the fact that my career has brought me to this spectacular region throughout so much of my life. That to me is the dominant feeling, the dominant impression is just gratitude. And I'm so grateful that I've been able to return, even though it's a shorter trip than I used to make, and even though I no longer work full-time in conservation. If I look back over my career, I've gotten paid, or at the very least, had my expenses covered, to visit the most amazing places, to see rare animals, to interact with and learn from local people in a way that I likely never would or could have as a tourist. Just a few weeks ago, for example, I was lucky enough to be on survey with one of my most important mentors, Dr. Luella Dolar, in the Philippines. And I couldn't believe how beautiful some of our survey sites were. This is something that, for example, coral reef scientists probably experience regularly, but for someone like me who studies primarily an estuarine, riverine, brackish, water-loving species, this is pretty rare. We were literally on empty white sand beaches fringed with coconut palms, gazing out over impossibly turquoise water, searching for charismatic large marine animals. It was ridiculous. And in case those muddy water fans are unhappy with me suggesting that those ecosystems aren't also beautiful, yes, they have their own beauty to them, but I'm going to say it's more of a subtle beauty and not the kind of hit you over the head with astonishment like, you know, those white sand beaches and turquoise waters do. With that appreciation comes the awareness or the reminder that the ability to do this is a huge privilege, especially for those of us who aren't from the countries where we do research, right? And a respected friend and colleague who left mainstream conservation to do fantastic work in a tangentially related field, but with a lot less field work, put it perfectly to me. She said, "It's really hard to let go of the privilege of conservation field work." Plus, there's the privilege of being able to be smug about it. Yeah, I'm being open and honest here. It's definitely not one of the main things I feel when I get to travel for work, but I've experienced it, and I know many of you have too. There's a tendency to feel like we're somehow better than tourists, like we're special because we're living the explorer, adventurer, National Geographic dream. We're traveling with a purpose, with a capital P, after all, right? I want to encourage all of us, and by us I mean, again, those of us who are coming from the global north to work in places in the global south. I want to encourage us to really explore that assumption, though. And if you're a listener who's actually from the global south, I would totally understand if you just said, hey, this episode really isn't targeted toward me. I'm not going to finish listening to it. But if you do listen and you had any, and if you have any feedback about anything I missed or got wrong, I would love to hear from you. Back on track, we need to explore the assumption that we are traveling with an important purpose. What is our purpose in all of this? What will result from our privileged expeditions, from our time in lush green forests and stunning tropical waters on island atolls that no one else really ever gets to visit? What will all of the data that we are so importantly, capital I, importantly collecting go toward? And what else are we doing with our time in those places? Are we doing anything truly meaningful with these opportunities? Are we giving back? For many of us, not all again, but those of us who are from the global north and have relative privilege in terms of access to education and funding, etc., the fact that we have these opportunities is due to structural conditions that are linked to the legacy of colonization and globalization, conditions that unequally benefit us while detracting from the opportunities of our peers in the global south. I mean, I've had more opportunities to see special natural areas in Southeast Asia than many local students from Southeast Asia have had. And that's not fair. I've benefited from it. I really appreciate that I have, but it's still not fair. And so for those of us from the global north especially, we should stay grounded and honest about the privilege that we enjoy and the responsibilities that come with it. We didn't earn these privileges by kind of our sheer inherent merit, right? Like, it was given to us in part because of the context in which we were raised, in which we grew up, in which we were educated, in which we pursue our careers. It's not something that we inherently deserve. We should make real efforts to contribute positively to the places where we work and to the stakeholders who are linked to them and who, in many cases, really help us. And if we don't make our purpose as conservationists real, then we are just glorified tourists. So I know that making an impact in conservation is generally said to be time-consuming and challenging. And that is true to the extent that we're focusing on saving a population or supporting positive ethical change in resource user rights and governance. Of course, these things take time. Of course, they're challenging and complex. But there are a lot of smaller, more readily attainable things that we can do to leave a positive impact. We can allocate our project funding toward outreach, toward training for aspiring local researchers or students, toward useful activities for local communities. Of course, in all of this, collaborating with the target users to ensure that these activities are actually useful and beneficial. We can train local students or research assistants in skills that they can use moving forward, and maybe is directly related to your fieldwork. Of course, they're going to learn that anyway. But also, what about grant writing or preparing CVs or using social media for outreach, for example, things that they can use after your project ends? We can also help our local colleagues edit the English language in their reports and manuscripts if they aren't fluent in English or if some, you know, prejudiced journal editor or journal reviewer decides that they're clearly not native English speakers and they have to have their paper reviewed by a native English speaker. That's a pet peeve. And we can also connect them to funding sources that maybe we have more access to. We can amplify their voices in places where they're still underrepresented. We can advocate for more meaningful diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts in international meetings and societies, for example. And the bare minimum would be to share our data and outputs with all collaborating and permitting individuals and institutions. This is a pretty low bar. And yet, embarrassingly, many visiting researchers don't even do that. I mean, you've probably recalled some stories about this from previous episodes. And to people who've done that, I just want to yell, like, don't act like it's your property that you somehow collected totally independently and in a vacuum. A lot of people probably had to help you in some way or another along multiple steps in the process. So include them as authors and or acknowledgements, depending on, you know, the agreement that you all come to on what's appropriate. And discuss this ahead of time. Get it down in writing so that everything is clear with everyone. And as a side note, but it's related, are there any fans of the movie My Cousin Vinny here? If you haven't seen it, slight spoiler and profanity alert. So at the end, when Vinny is dissatisfied that he only won his case with the help of his fiancée, Mona Lisa Vito, he says, "My problem is I wanted to win my first case without any help from anybody." And she replies, "You know, this could be a sign of things to come. You win all your cases, but with somebody else's help, right? You win case after case. And then afterwards, you have to go up to someone and you have to say, 'Thank you.' Oh my God, what a fucking nightmare." So, you know, whenever I think of people acting like their achievements occurred in a vacuum and were attained in as a solely solo endeavor, I think of this quote. Anyway, I haven't had the impact in conservation that many people might envision when they think of the grand goals of the field. None of my research has gotten any threatened population of animals any farther away from extinction. And it hasn't been applied to any specific actions toward improved fisheries management that I know of. Probably not. But what I can say is that I have made a difference. Like, I'm very proud of the fact that I've been able to train several young local researchers who carry on the work that we started together in Myanmar 6 or so years ago. You know, they're taking the work far beyond what it ever was when I was there working directly with them. And they get all the credit for that. But at the same time, I also want to emphasize that I was able to do that. And that wasn't even the main part of my work. And that's to emphasize that making a difference is possible and it doesn't have to be an all-consuming endeavor. Like, you can do these things as part of a broader suite of work. I'm also proud of the stakeholder-centered activities that I developed and delivered with a fantastic team of collaborators, activities that I believe actually did make a difference to how people approach the sharing and discussion of information and feedback in the communities where we worked in Myanmar. I'm proud of the talks, workshops, and consulting outputs I've delivered where I've shared broader insights into how conservation functions and which have made an impact on my audiences who hopefully will apply those insights in their projects on the ground. And yes, I'm proud of the small, like really modest outreach events that my team at my main PhD site did with kids in local fishing villages like 14 years ago, where the kids absolutely lit up, like they absolutely were just glowing while dancing with a giant dolphin mascot and playing trivia games about dolphins. And these events were easy and fun to plan. I mean, we were lucky that WWF Philippines had the dolphin costume handy. I was lucky that I had a really great, energetic team who were really connected with the local community. But this wasn't really a main part of my PhD was education, but we found a way with my shoestring budget and pretty demanding schedule to fit this in. And sure, like these kinds of outreach events are not ever going to be a deciding factor in the fate of the local dolphins, but it still felt like we did something good, something that the community enjoyed and something that the kids, at least some of them, hopefully remembered. So I know that list might come off as me being like, I'm amazing. But no, it's to demonstrate that we can contribute in a way that matters on a time scale and effort scale that's lower than what's needed to save a whole population of an endangered species, right? And sure, it requires mindfulness and effort, but I think it's easier than a lot of people might expect. And I think it means more than a lot of people realize. So some of the points that I brought up earlier, you know, about what we can do with our privilege and our responsibility in these situations, they relate to being a respectful contributing member of a community of researchers. And again, this is especially important if you are an outsider like me. An outsider meaning I'm not from Southeast Asia, but I am very much included in a wonderful, vibrant community of Southeast Asian researchers. And I am incredibly appreciative of my community of colleagues, which also happens to be a fantastic community of friends. And being able to reconnect in person with several of them on this trip for the first time in years has reminded me how supported and cared for I am as part of this community. And in turn, I truly embrace any opportunity I might have to be of any help or support to any of them. It's amazing. And it's a big part of why I maintain my involvement in the field, and it's a big part of the really profound appreciation I've been feeling throughout this trip. I mean, I just love how there are so many collaborations across the region with people selflessly sharing their time, energy, and knowledge, even though everyone is scrambling to maintain enough resources, money, time, energy for their own organizations and work and lives. And my experience in this community has really shown me that building inclusive community together is one of the most important things that conservationists can do. And building this network of shared care and support and information and ideation and experience sharing, I mean, that's really priceless. You know, it helps people who are working in what can be isolating, disheartening, incredibly difficult work. And so I do want to emphasize, you know, to young researchers, well, old researchers too, whoever, like, don't neglect that part of your kind of professional journey. And that's not to be strategic about it. I don't advocate networking solely for the advantages that you will be able to leverage as a result of your connections. I really believe that sincere, authentic community building those connections is central to the long-term sustainability of this field and of the people working in it. You know, there might be individual conservation heroes featured in headlines and who's who lists, but real conservation work is a broader community effort. And it's a shame that the current struggle to find adequate funding and sure, the occasional ego run amok injects a sense of urgent competition into what really needs to be a shared collaborative effort. And I'm so grateful that I've encountered so much kindness and generosity that still exists in the community that I'm a part of. Let's see, I also wanted to touch on a broader sense of appreciating and not abusing the privilege that I have. Going back to my earlier mention of the over-exploitation that plagues the environments of this region and many others. First, I've been struck by this trip by a prevailing sense of the creeping reach of mass tourism, with even as yet undeveloped beach lots already bought up by outsiders in the aforementioned gorgeous field sites in the Philippines that I got to visit a few weeks ago. Second, a couple of weeks ago, I drove by an absolute hellscape of metals mining in Mindanao, another part of the Philippines, with denuded hills, bays just stained a reddish brown from the sedimentation, and dust-covered villages. It was grim. But in both cases, you know, tourism and mining, I had to acknowledge that my impacts on the planet are not removed from either of these sectors, right? I've been a tourist to plenty of places, and I try, but I don't always do research to ensure that I'm supporting locally owned businesses, for example. And I use, say, electronics that require mined components. And beyond that, I drive a car extensively. You know, this is the Southern California lifestyle. And I take flights, especially on this trip. It's been a lot of hopping around. And this all contributes to the increasingly unstable weather that harms local fishers and farmers here. So how do I, as someone who takes the privilege of traveling to the global south to purportedly contribute to environmental sustainability, reconcile with the impacts that I have? It's one thing to shake my head in disgust as I'm driven past a mining site. It's another to learn more about, okay, where do the materials that I consume come from and how are they extracted? And what are the environmental and social costs of that? And then it's still more to take decisive steps to reduce my use of such materials. And I know that transparency in value chains makes it really challenging as a consumer to do all that, but this has really renewed my somewhat lapsed commitment to being a more thoughtful, informed consumer. Okay, well, the day is in full swing here in the streets below me. Lots of motorbikes whizzing past, and I have a full itinerary of vegetarian foraging to pursue before meeting up with some of my aforementioned colleagues later today. So I won't take this time to try to present any solutions or neat conclusions, because it seems like it would be challenging, require a lot more time and energy than I have, and in the end, perhaps just be kind of an artificial ending to wrap the episode up nicely when there really are no such neat solutions or conclusions. I hope that those of us who do have the immense privilege, as I do, of traveling for fieldwork, as a whole, that we work to be more mindful of our responsibility and our impacts, both as researchers and as humans. And other than that, I'll just say that I'm really glad to be back to posting Conservation Realist episodes, and I'm excited to share some more informative, training-based episodes in the near future as well. We'll see about the frequency of posting. I mean, if you were with me throughout season one, you know that it's always a surprise, but I am aspiring toward more regular posting in the coming months. Thank you for listening, and as ever, any likes, shares, comments, and even donations are sincerely appreciated. Now, I'll leave you with the song, The Green Touch, by talented Myanmar musicians Somo Twin, Xian Tet, and Min Min. All right, till next episode.
Yala he Doka baji ye sing ko dan we na swin le Ludaro alo pyo shwin za ya re pe swan ne Tu pyon re a pyu se lo le Say la ne La baji ye gong go saun ne tu la re Naishin lumia beya rima tu tali Goshe ware mimi buhe Seite la dune o sote la pane Along pe ma lo du Gagwenai mare Bawo chin la pala bo ye La la lo ku ba le Da ba wa ye myo sa da pa bo le Da ba wa ye ta ya re Min ti nai ma ze Min alo na ta min twe chi le Du tain tain cha so na ga ma le May and we tweet it on any. So shall we? Mimi Tazu Niko Mountama Time Belly. We need to salute the song Gali Tay Tay. Ludaima Kozi Tao Shibi. Loba say do ne o chap pie like ba 네 맹가 살로 도두 가괴나이 바레 버워진 라팔라보이 랄랄로 구마리 바와이 묘사다 바보레 바와이 태아리 민티나이 마세 민알로다 다이민트위치레 두테이테이자소 나가마네 메이엔위트위제로레리 바원진 라팔라보예 랄랄로 구발레 바와이 묘사다 바보레 바와이 대아리 멘티나이 마세 멘로다 다이멘트위지리 바워진 라팔라보예 랄랄로 구발레 바와이 묘사다 바보레 바와이 대아리 멘티나이 마세 멘로다 다이멘트위지리 두테이테이자소 나가마네 메이에르 트위제노레리